Across the country, a craze for cupcakes is merging with the social media phenomenon, and the result is cupcake trucks. Most major cities have such vendors, and they rely on Facebook and Twitter to connect with their customers. NPR's Jeff Brady, lucky guy, hitched a ride on the Denver cupcake truck.
Each morning, Sean Moore, a.k.a. the Cupcake Guy, loads up his 1969 Ford delivery truck with sugary cakes. Moore bounces over Denver's streets. Plenty of people stare and some wave as we pass by, then our destination.
Well, we're in Highlands neighborhood in Denver, and right now I'm scoping out a spot to park.
Moore finds the perfect space, plenty of businesses nearby and lots of people walking. He sets his cupcakes on the counter and he's open for business.
Then I pull out my computer and basically link up with all my social networks and let them know where I'm at and how long I'll be here.
Within just a few minutes, customers are responding online, and in no time at all, Patty McKenna shows up with one very insistent young man.
Hey, you follow us online?
Well, I know cupcakes, buddy.
That's her toddler son, Everett.
He's only a little excited.
No, he doesn't sound excited at all.
A few minutes later, a slightly more sedate John Scraybeck pops in for a Denver snowball and a pistachio cupcake.
I work around the corner, and I'm always on Facebook because I use social media for my business, real estate.
So if you hadn't logged on to Facebook this morning and hadn't seen the message that this truck was right around the corner, would you be eating a cupcake now?
Probably not.
And there you have it, evidence that social media can successfully be used to sell cupcakes. Moore sells dozens each day at $2.75 each. The goal is for the truck to bring in $1,000 a day. That'll augment sales at the bakery Moore and his wife own. The great thing about social media, he says, it's cheaper than traditional advertising.
There are downsides to it, and that's the time. We spend hours updating our blog, updating Facebook, updating everything.
But the benefits are worth it, says Moore's wife, Denon. Back at the bakery, she says social media also is good for market research. Customers suggest popular places to park the truck, and she says they always have new flavor ideas.
Well, everyone wants bacon.
Yep, bacon cupcakes. Moore says she was skeptical, too.
But, you know, Elvis loved bacon, banana, and peanut butter. We're probably going to try and do something with bacon, banana, and peanut butter.
Soon, says Moore. Meanwhile, she made some maple bacon cupcakes, and they were a big hit. Jeff Rady, NPR News, Denver.
I want some more cookies.
Okay.
Customers waiting for Apple's new iPhone are finding supply restricted. Pre-orders, as they're called, began this week, and demand far outstrips supply. Now phones that were supposed to arrive next week will not be shipped until next month. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
More than 600,000 people have ordered the new iPhone. It's a staggeringly high number, and it caught Apple and AT&T off guard. Yesterday, the telecommunications company said it would not take any new orders for a while. Another problem, some customers complained that when they logged on to their AT&T accounts, they were able to see other subscribers' personal information. The company said it was investigating. Pete Fader, a marketing expert at the Wharton School, says this week's problems are just the latest that AT&T has had supporting the extremely popular smartphone.
It really is inexcusable that they've been so poor at managing this gift that's been handed to them.
The gift is the company's exclusive right to provide iPhone service. For its part, Apple acknowledges that many customers were turned away or gave up in frustration. Nonetheless, demand for the new phone remains strong. Fader says that reflects unshakable product loyalty.
These issues don't deter people in the least. It's okay, I'll just have to keep trying. And that speaks volumes about the success of this product.
Not to mention, he adds, the success of the marketing behind it. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
As soon as the spill began, BP started reaching out to Americans over the internet. It's been posting videos of the cleanup on its YouTube channel, and it's using Facebook and Twitter to post links to news stories and updates on the spill. NPR's Carolyn Beeler reports on whether or not BP's social media campaign is working.
A video on BP's YouTube channel shows a company vice president standing on a sandy beach. Workers in the background clean along the shoreline with shovels and garbage bags.
We have 25,000 people. They're working in five different states. And all of this has happened over 8 weeks.
The video is one of dozens that highlights BP's response efforts. Sites like YouTube and Facebook have allowed the company to communicate directly with the public. Crisis management expert Chris Lehane says BP has been good about putting information where people can get it whenever they want.
I think they did a very good job identifying the communication outlets that exist in the new digital world. But I think they have fallen into the age-old crisis 101 do-not-do list, which is to rush out information, which has turned out not to be accurate.
Lehane says with so many new places to put information, companies can feel a lot of pressure to get their message out fast in times of crisis. A BP spokesman says that's not what's happening at his company. He says it puts the same information on its social media sites that it releases to the traditional media, like newspapers and TV. But to some, that's the real flaw in BP's strategy. Jeff Livingston runs a social media marketing company. He says when he looks at the BP America Facebook page, he sees a company talking at people.
So if we look at BP America's Facebook page, all right, this is an interesting one. So I'm looking at
Livingston says BP is just messaging people. That's fine for an ad campaign, but it doesn't work well on Facebook, where people expect a dialogue.
So when you have a two-way channel like Facebook or Twitter, you're expected to have a conversation. And eventually, when you don't have a conversation with people and you just put out messages and ignore them, people feel like you're not really there.
Katie Oliver lives nowhere near the Gulf. Still, the Wisconsin resident wants to learn more about the disaster, find ways to help, and express her frustrations. She posted a message on the BP Facebook page telling the company to pay up, clean up, and get out. But she says she's more drawn to sites like the Boycott BP page. The tone is negative on these anti-BP sites, but at least they're telling her something she can do.
People want to be a part of something, and I think that's why the anti ones are going to have more of an effect on people.
There are Facebook pages that support BP, but most tap into the public's anger. An anonymous user set up a fake BP Twitter account under the official sounding name BP Global PR. Here's a recent post. If you must cry over this oil spill, please don't do it in the Gulf. Saltwater ruins our oil. That fake Twitter account has 10 times more followers than BP's official Twitter stream. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with us as usual. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Michelle. Well, Sunday is Father's Day, and a couple of our dad-themed features this week got folks buzzing online. One of our conversations was with Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's the author of the book Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Now, in it, he describes his early fascination with hip-hop music and street culture and how his father steered him away from all of that to become, as he describes, more intellectually curious. Here's a clip from our conversation with Williams.
My father was disturbed by the extent to which I was interested in both hip-hop and sports. I write a lot about how sports, especially basketball, really went hand in hand with the hip-hop culture that I was immersed in. So your physical prowess mattered, whether it was your swagger in the street or your game on the basketball court, but your mind didn't necessarily matter.
Well, we heard from some folks who took issue with Williams' description of hip-hop culture. Here's a post we received from blogger Leslie. She writes, as an African-American, avid fan of hip-hop, a voracious reader, and a science groupie, I am quite offended by the implication that hip-hop is anti-intellectual. I only listen to intellectual hip-hop, and that's all I've ever really listened to. She goes on to write that Williams is judging the art in the way that he has been judged and through a narrow lens, and then he had to write a book about it.
All right, Leslie, thank you for weighing in. I have a feeling that we're going to have more conversations along these lines.
I think so.
I think this is a rich topic.
Yeah, I think so.
Lee, this week we also heard from Tell Me More director, producer, and author Rob Sachs. He and his wife are expecting their second child, and Rob penned a commentary about the anxiety that comes with picking a name.
choosing the name Rachel for our first child was an agonizing process that involved list upon list and lots of late-night bargaining. But we're very happy with our choice. And that's a good thing. It turns out that 3% of parents regret the name they gave their child, according to a 2007 survey by the website babycenter.com.
Lee, in response to that commentary, Adam posted this note to our website. He says, while naming your child is a big event, the fact that 3% of parents regret the name they gave their child is really underwhelming. And if you name your child something you regret, I can assure you that will be the smallest thing you regret as a parent, and really not as huge a deal as you're making it out to be. But Adam writes, congratulations on becoming a father. It's a great experience. Enjoy every moment. Thank you, Adam. But I will say that there is research that shows that certain ethnic names do have an impact in the marketplace, and I do think that that's something that is worth thinking about, in fact, probably even doing some more reporting on. So thank you, Adam, and thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, whether it's about our conversation with Thabo Mbeki, Melissa Etheridge, or our Gulf oil spill coverage, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More and blog it out.
Another technology story now, this one from North Carolina. On the Camp Lejeune Marine Corps base, large reflective rectangles line the rooftops of many homes. They're not some high-tech military gadget or satellite dish. They're solar panels for heating water. In fact, so many have gone up in one neighborhood that it's quickly becoming the largest community in the continental U.S. to heat water with energy from the sun. From member station WHQR, Catherine Welch reports.
An American flag flies from the porch of Sergeant Kirk Paulson and his wife's light brown house. The Paulsons live on the corner of a cul-de-sac where every home on the block has a 10-by-4-foot solar panel smack in the middle of the roof. The solar panel is a new addition to the Paulson home, one they're proud of.
And it's kind of like a milestone in our history books for the Marine Corps, for state of North Carolina, and for the continental U.S. So I feel very proud of that, that we're conserving it for our children's children's children.
Eventually, solar panels will sit on top of 900 homes in this Camp Lejeune neighborhood. Recently, the Paulsons sacrificed a little privacy and let some energy officials and North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue into their home to poke around the utility closet.
If any home has a roof that gets some sun, does it matter the direction of the sun?
Michael Shore says no. He's the president of FLS Energy, the company behind the solar panels. He says they act like a greenhouse, heating a fluid that runs down pipes inside the house, transferring heat into a 40-gallon water tank with temperatures reaching 180 degrees. Shore says solar panels are one of the most cost-effective ways to generate energy.
And we have this myth in this country that renewable energy is expensive. And here Camp Lejeune and the housing company are saving money through solar. So I think we are really in the midst of a shift on how our nation gets its energy.
Shore says energy from the sun can heat 3/4 of the water used in a typical household. Marines living on base don't pay utility bills. So who's saving money? Camp Lejeune, sort of. FLS buys all of the solar panels and equipment and sells the hot water to the company that runs Camp Lejeune's on-base housing. FLS has done this before, and it's with populations of individuals who don't have to foot the water bill themselves. It's tacked solar panels on top of hotels, college dorms, prisons, places that use a lot of hot water.
So the military was, you know, the next and maybe the best frontier, just because there's so much hot water that's used on a base.
It'll cost FLS $6 million to hook up all 900 homes on base to solar water heaters. For the average civilian homeowner, the out-of-pocket cost can run as much as $7,000. Sergeant Kirk Paulson and his wife Jamie have only had their solar hot water heater for a few weeks, but they say so far there have been no surprise cold showers.
When we're taking a shower or whatnot, the water is always nice and warm. We want a warm shower, you know, the cold day, there's always warm water available.
After conquering the Marines, FLS Energy has its sights set on bringing solar water heaters to families in the other branches of the military. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch.
This is NPR.
The recent upset over privacy on Facebook hasn't gone unnoticed in Washington. For the first time in years, Congress is talking seriously about a new internet privacy law. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, the industry is worried the new rules will go too far.
Any rewrite of federal privacy law is sure to affect big companies like Google. But as the lobbying on the issue heats up, the big boys are staying out of sight. Instead, owners of small websites have been wandering the halls of Congress. They're being shepherded around Capitol Hill by the Interactive Advertising Bureau, an industry trade group. The IAB's Mike Zanis says the small internet companies make the most effective lobbyists against restrictive new privacy laws.
Because once you meet these entrepreneurs, it's very hard to introduce a piece of legislation that would put a mom-and-pop shop out of business, potentially.
One of those mom-and-pop shops is James Martin's website, IkeaFans.com. It's not affiliated with IKEA itself, but it addresses certain issues encountered by IKEA customers.
For some reason, some people have difficulty putting together IKEA furniture.
So when those people are stuck with a half-built Hentzvik bookshelf, they can come to Martin's website for help. He makes his living selling ad space, ads that are tailored to the site's visitors based on information collected about them as they click around the site. And that's where Congress may step in. One idea is that websites like IkeaFans.com should prominently disclose the kind of data they collect. Martin says that would be bad for business.
It would kill it. It would kill it.
He says his site respects users' privacy, but a disclosure notice would send the opposite message.
When they see a big warning, they're immediately going to assume that we're doing something nefarious.
The disclosure requirement is part of a draft of a privacy bill that's expected to be introduced soon in the House Subcommittee on Communications, Technology, and the Internet. Committee Chairman Rick Boucher, a Democrat from Virginia, says his bill is not meant to scare off website customers. In fact, he's trying to give them more confidence.
There's a lot of uncertainty on people's part about what information is collected from them when they visit websites and how that information is used and with whom it's shared.
As the bill moves through Congress, the big fight will be over what the wonks call opt-in versus opt-out. Opt-in rules require your consent before your data is collected. Opt-out lets the website collect information until you say no. Civil liberties groups prefer opt-in, advertisers opt-out. So far, Boucher's draft bill splits the difference, applying opt-in only to more sensitive kinds of information.
There's a lot of criticism of the bill.
Leslie Harris is head of the Center for Democracy and Technology.
I will say this. Congressman Boucher has stepped up to start the conversation that everybody has been sort of unwilling to have on Capitol Hill, and that's a very important first step.
There is a political risk here because the legislation affects more than just advertising. The behavioral data gathered by commercial websites has become a rich resource for law enforcement.
The government has fairly easy access to almost all this information that's being collected by companies online. So the consumer laws will also be important in limiting these, honeypots that we're creating for the government.
Following 9/11, Congress was reluctant to pass any legislation that might limit data available to investigators, but that reluctance is now fading. Harris says for the first time in years, internet privacy is no longer a partisan issue. Martin Costi, NPR News.